Hello and welcome to the fifth episode of How to Be an Independent Country, Scotland's Choices. My name is Connor Matchett. I'm the Deputy Political Editor at The Scotsman. And in this limited podcast series, we are examining whether there are lessons for Scotland in the experiences of other countries' independence. In the last episode, we looked at different health systems and the perils of setting up a country in the image of a political leader. We've also explored the question of borders, what sort of democracy Scotland may become, and the potential for a Scottish currency. In this episode, we will explore what sort of relationship independent countries have had with their neighbours and the rest of the world. This includes significant questions which an independent Scotland would have to face, including whether or not to join the European Union or NATO, both central hopes of the current SNP leadership. Foreign policy in Europe is also complicated by the former existence of the Soviet Union and the Communist Bloc, something which only began disintegrating in the early 1990s. Rick Fawn is a professor of international relations at the University of St Andrews and a specialist on international security. He has worked for decades on researching the former communist space in Europe and is one of the leading experts on the region, including countries such as Czechoslovakia. The two countries, now Czech Republic and Slovakia, split in 1992 and can be highlighted as an example of newly independent countries forging their own foreign policy.
Perhaps a starting point is to mention one of the two people who was really responsible for that breakup. And this is a breakup that didn't have a referendum behind it. There wasn't a popular decision behind it, although it was one that was put into place and very quickly and very effectively. And that person is Václav Klaus. And he would say that breaking up countries is actually relatively easy to do. So on the one hand, I think we should be cautious about what all is involved. But on the other hand, these things aren't impossible to do. And many units have starting places. We see across the post-communist space, which has generated more than two dozen new countries in the past 30 years, that they all had a starting point because they had constitutional autonomy in their countries, in Czechoslovakia, in Yugoslavia, in the Soviet Union. And that gave them the semblance of state structures. There were places, there were people, office holders, offices that looked and functioned like a state. So it's very possible to start the process of foreign policy fairly quickly. And then that can take many different forms. There can be informal sides of this. The outreach that is done by personalities, they can be, for example, business, sporting, and so on. So this can be done. And in the case of the Czech Republic and Slovakia, they affected it very, very quickly. I mean, it really was in the space of a few weeks. There was a parliamentary decision in November of 1992, which might feel a very long time away, and they were ordained as new states on the 1st of January 1993. And in that case, what happened was there were people within the former federal foreign ministry who were charged with reviewing all the physical assets that the ministry had. So that means embassies, residences around the world. In many cases, they were visited, and these were then divided up between the two countries. And in some cases, one successor state came out much better than the other. You could have quite a glorious property, you know, sometimes very difficult to divide physically properties. But it did mean that both countries ended up with a staff of their own and with facilities of their own. In that case, you can see quite a discrepancy. The federal foreign ministry, which then became the Czech one, is in a very, very grand palace on the Castle Hill of Prague, whereas the Slovaks ended up with, I'm very fond of that ministry and the building and I visited it, but a rather modern looking, less descriptive entity.
What were the main challenges for these new states in the early 1990s? What obstacles existed for them establishing themselves within a global world, now changing beyond recognition at pace?
It may feel a very long time ago, although some aspects of the war in Ukraine now actually bring us back to that. So in the early 1990s, we did not have a European community or a NATO that actually welcomed these countries. We may take that for granted now, but those countries actually had to work very, very hard to convince both of those organizations to open their doors. And one of the ways that those countries did it was to cooperate among themselves, to send out a very positive image. We can cooperate. We're not hostile to one another. We're leaving the animosities of our old history, which is a very, very nationalistic history in that region, and also that they would be contributors to what they called Europe. They weren't wanting to join Europe, they were wanting to come back to it. They also had very particular security issues because they were exiting the Soviet bloc system, and that included 500,000 combat troops from the Soviet Union across their region, and it also included two massive regional organizations which basically controlled their foreign and economic policies. So they disassembled those and put themselves on a Euro-Atlantic track. Now we know, years on, that they were very, very successful in doing that, but it took an awful lot of work. And one of the reasons that it worked so well for them is that they had new political personalities of tremendous personal stature and of international following. And there are two in particular. There are many other names that are less familiar, but two in particular, Lech Wałęsa, the Solidarity leader in Poland who won a Nobel Peace Prize, and the dissident playwright Václav Havel. So these were people who were well known at the time, people of tremendous moral standing, who were making the case for their countries. And I actually think that made a fundamental difference to the trajectories of their countries.
The early years of newly discovered independence and that approach to international relations was not immediate success. In fact, the two countries had different experiences despite coming from the same previously existing union. Professor Fawn explains.
It was a non-linear process. For the Czech Republic, it was a little more straightforward because they had embarked on the most ambitious economic reforms of the entire post-Soviet bloc. The Slovak case was different because for a number of years, it had a leader. This is the other leader who helped break up Czechoslovakia, who was actually anti-democratic and hostile to minorities. And he ensured in very short order that actually Slovakia fell out of the frontline states for euro accession. And that was really made evident by the fact that Poland, Czech Republic, and Hungary got into NATO in 1999. Slovakia did not, and it had to wait longer. So they had somewhat different processes, and that was very much because of different domestic political agendas. What it tells us, I think, is that if you want to integrate or reintegrate into the Euro-Atlantic space, there are very specific and some informal expectations that have to be met. There's a formal process of accession. I mean, we're seeing this with Finland and Sweden, two of the most wealthy, successful countries in the world, applying for NATO membership. You know, there are literally criteria that have to be fulfilled to gain entry in either of those organizations. And in the 1990s, we had a process where these countries undertook massive reforms to meet these criteria and where they were subject to annual reviews. In many ways, it was a public, sometimes embarrassing process because the European Commission would produce these annual reports on each country and show how their progress was. And likewise, NATO. NATO actually had quite a substantial accession process. And by 1995, having said in 1994 that there would be enlargement, in 1995, NATO issued what it called the study on enlargement, and it had a series of criteria that countries were expected to meet. And many of them were actually political. It wasn't all about being a good, compatible military partner. It was about having a certain type of domestic polity, a polity that respected the rule of law, democracy, minority rights.
One thing was certain after the collapse of the communist regimes in Eastern Europe, and that was the decision to return to a Eurocentric outlook. This is a similar, but not really broadly comparable type of discussion as is occurring in Scotland currently in relation to joining the European Union post-independence.
There was a lot of discussion, but the direction was very, very clear and from the outset. The Mečiar scenario, which didn't endure, aside, the Czechoslovak, the Czech, and some of the Slovak elite were absolutely clear about this reorientation to the West and Euro-Atlantic accession. So in this case, there weren't the divides that we see in some of the post-Soviet countries, because they're working in a very, very different dynamic. In the Czech and Slovak cases, ultimately, it was absolutely very, very clear where they wanted to go. And again, there was an existential dimension. There was an identity dimension, which was really quite fundamental. To them, they were not applying to join. They were rejoining. They were making the case. The novelist Milan Kundera put this quite brilliantly in an essay in 1983, published in English in 1984, where Central Europe had been kidnapped and dragged eastwards. It didn't physically move anywhere, but culturally, spiritually, it had been pulled eastwards. And what happened in 1989 is that these countries were able to rejoin Europe. And very, very literally, the slogan, both in political circles and in common parlance throughout the media, was back to Europe.
There was, however, a significant difference for those newly independent countries in the former Soviet Union, with the paths to membership of the European Union and NATO much more difficult. Professor Fawn explains why.
It functions at least on two levels. The first level is that much, not all, but much of the countries that were in the European part of the Soviet Union did not have the same, and I think calling it civilizational is a right word, they didn't have the same civilizational experience as the Central Europeans. And that means all of the things that Europe considers to be fundamental to being European. That means the Renaissance, the Reformation, the Enlightenment, industrialization. The westernmost parts of Belarus and the western parts of Ukraine did, because they were in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. But the larger parts, the eastern parts of those countries, and indeed all of Russia, did not experience that. So their historical development, their economic development was fundamentally different. And when we get this idea propagated by the American political scientist Samuel Huntington in the early to mid-1990s of a clash of civilizations, we get a physical dividing line which runs to the east of the Baltic states. It runs through Belarus and Ukraine and then through Romania, cutting off the part of Romania that was in the Austro-Hungarian Empire and excluding the eastern part that wasn't. And that is a Western Christian divide versus an Eastern Orthodox divide. And it's absolutely astonishing now to consider that, perhaps coincidentally, but perhaps not, that the membership of both NATO and the EU is almost exactly the same in terms of its eastern frontier with that civilizational divide. So that's the very first thing. A lot of the European lands of what was the former Soviet Union did not have what we consider to be elemental European developmental phenomena. That's not to say that Russia and Russian culture is not European. It is very, very much. And it's a major contributor to things that are fundamentally European. But in terms of these massive things that developed mentalities, economies, structures of societies, and so forth, these were largely absent. Then the second thing is the difference between being a member of the Soviet bloc and still being a country, like a Poland, like a Hungary, a Czechoslovakia, Bulgaria, and then being inside the Soviet Union. And the USSR stood for the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, as a republic within that construct. So those countries were very literally run by Moscow. And they had the intensity of being in the Soviet Communist Party. So they didn't have the freedom of movement, which could be curtailed very, very easily, but the freedom of movement that some of the socialist countries were able to develop. And we see the repercussions of that today. With some hesitation, Russia in the 1990s was willing to let the Central European countries go, even the Baltic states go, and to come into the EU. NATO was a different matter for security reasons, but accession to the EU was not an issue for Moscow initially. It is a fundamental issue for countries that were core members of the Soviet Union. So the Baltics are aside. They were only there for, and painful a history it was for them, but for four decades. Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, they were there for 70 years. And it's those countries where there is a monumental contestation between the West and Moscow. And long before 2014, and that is the annexation of Crimea, the war in Donbass, and those, of course, are direct lineage for the horrendous cataclysm that we have in Ukraine now. You know, long before that, it was very, very clear to me that Moscow was extremely concerned in official statement upon official statement that both NATO and the European Union, and that's an important distinction, that both of those organizations were making zero-sum claims on these post-Soviet states. So Moscow had even more of a red line on how countries that were in the Soviet bloc were to be treated by the West. And that included the South Caucasus. So Russia's attack on Georgia in 2008 was part of this discourse, part of this idea that there are red lines. You do not have Euro-Atlantic expansion into the former Soviet Union. So those are two massive sets of historical, political, security overplay that makes a big distinction between Central Southeastern Europe and the Baltic states on one hand and the post-Soviet states on the other.
So is Scotland's current debate around foreign policy and potential future after independence comparable? Not really, says Professor Fawn.
They're not immediately comparable, first and just briefly, because the post-communist countries had to do so many fundamental restructurings, including creating really from scratch a market economy and then an administrative, bureaucratic, legal transformation. You know, at that time, in the later 90s, the acquis communautaire, this body of laws that is the European Union, was 80,000 pages. It's now well over 100,000. You know, it's like spores that keep growing. And you had situations where national parliaments passed scores and scores of legislation, because all of this EU law had to become domestic law. They just passed this law with no debate in parliament because they knew they needed it. It wasn't worth debating and just doing it. But these were countries that were economically, administratively, already in a better position than some of the post-Soviet states. And they had the benefit of an internationalized elite. I mean, many of them had diasporas that could come back. This was particularly the case in the Baltic states. You've had several leaders of the Baltic countries, presidents, prime ministers, foreign ministers, who were either born outside or are emigre. And these are, you know, established people who could come back and help the process. A lot of that, unfortunately, is absent in the post-Soviet case. And the Soviet rule for those seven decades crippled these economies and societal outlooks and the idea, let alone the functioning of civil society, so much more severely than was the case in Central Europe. So it'll be a much bigger process for these countries to do it. And that's before some other considerations. The EU and NATO are, in some regards, truly democratic bodies. Every accession has to be approved by every country. So we already see the risk of a veto for reasons that aren't immediately germane. We'll see that issue. We'll see that issue within the European Union because expansion, especially to economies that are less well-functioning, is a massive budgetary question. But Scotland is in a different position, and that is because of being in the UK and the UK having been in the European Union. The UK, by definition, had to adjust to everything that was the European Union. So there's an awful lot of holdover that would help any successor to the UK that wants to apply for EU membership. But it'll still be beholden to EU questions about, you know, for example, how much money do they want? What kind of contributions are they going to make? Does this, for example, mean something about Catalonia for Spain? Might that invoke a veto for particular interests? So there'll be a range of possibilities and questions.
Let us look now at one specific example. One of the few countries to decide to split up a historic union through a vote in a referendum was Montenegro, which did so in 2006. It faced similar challenges. Milena Besic, who we have heard from throughout the series, is the director of the Center for Democracy and Human Rights in Podgorica. She explains the political context behind Montenegro's early years of independence.
Internal affairs of Montenegro are complex, but I like to give this kind of approach. For someone who is listening from Scotland, for example, whole Montenegro has 600,000 inhabitants. This is like one common normal city, honestly. And is it possible that we cannot organize each other with so many resources? Because one city has like limited resources. It is on certain area and... We have every needed and possible, even our geographical position is fantastic. We are in the middle of Mediterranean. We have the coast on Mediterranean. We have fantastic climate conditions. We have water resources. We have every possible natural resources. And it is somehow like unbelievable that we are still here. And this is what politics can do. It's an interesting case for examination. And we thought that everything is going to be much easier when we are independent. But the opportunity to transform ourselves was somehow lost in that first flow after the referendum. We should prove our democratic capacity in changing the government several times, but that didn't happen. We had the same political party in power for 30 years, and it's not possible because that kind of political influence on institutions was too obvious. Americans defined it as state capture.
What about the approach to foreign policy?
It's very important and a big thing that, let's call it, we were always on the right side when it comes to foreign policy decisions. The majority in the parliament always supporting the pro-Western and pro-European and that course. That's the good thing, because the foreign policy of Montenegro is really important and good policy, because the main struggle was about joining the NATO alliance, since there was a very strong narrative in Serbia and Montenegro regarding NATO bombing in 1999, because NATO was bombing Serbia and Montenegro. And now, not so many years after, we are the partners and in that alliance. Coming back to your main question, it was easy, because even though we have a multi-political party parliament and system, the strong majority was for almost 30 years one big party. From time to time, depending on the elections, they had one or two main, let's say, coalition partners who were also, so that main party was the Democratic Party of Socialists, and also another smaller in support, also Social Democratic Party. And they were always on the same line when it comes to the foreign policy. So it was very easy to vote for this such kind of decisions in the parliament, which was good. But when it comes to the policies that are concerning our internal affairs, economy, rule of law, many other things which are very important, there we really faced real issues and real problems. When it comes to the foreign policy, it was not the problem to have majority in the parliament.
One part of Montenegro's current foreign policy is the debate around whether to join the Open Balkan Initiative. This is an economic and political zone, sometimes described as a mini Schengen, after the area of free movement of people in Europe. Its current members are North Macedonia, Albania, and Serbia, with prospective members including Kosovo, Bosnia and Herzegovina, and Montenegro. The political aspects of such a union are hard to ignore for Milena, however.
From my experience, I don't believe in any such a big initiative without political background. It has to have political background. And it would be really like naive believing that it is only a tool to overcome some obstacles, and that suddenly in this region we can cooperate and work together. It would be really, really naive. On the other side, all the countries involved are on the different level of democratic development. Each country has its own burden and obstacles towards the EU. For example, the North Macedonian situation is really tricky. They really suffered a lot with Greece because of the name, now with Bulgaria, and simply they have always some kind of threat from EU countries which are somehow making troubles on their own path. This is only without mentioning internal issues, such as always undeveloped economy, multi-ethnical issues, also corruption and organized crime, which is the issue and topic for all the Western Balkan countries, including Montenegro. So there are many, many things, but when we are talking about those, the, let's say, most important and the biggest one, which are like relation between the countries. Macedonia has that. Kosovo, it's a really, really special story. Relation between Serbia and Kosovo. Bosnia and Herzegovina. We would need like three separate podcasts, and it would be hard to explain complexity of their situation. And this is one of the reasons why from the highest addresses from the EU, we can hear that Montenegro is the front runner. Not because we gained the highest level of standards in democracy, but simply we have less big open issues when it comes to the foreign policy, relations, etc.
How does Montenegro tackle the question of how close it remains with its former partner, Serbia? And is it still a hot political topic?
Yes, especially since we changed the ruling party after 30 years, because pro-Serbian bloc got the power in the last election. And recently we had another change within the same election results. So we changed the government, and it's like minority government where minority has support of the opposition, which is previous majority DPS. Those guys that were in power for 30 years. Now, those guys which were in power for 30 years, after only like 14 months, get the opportunity to support new government. It's like a really complex thing. But of course, that Serbia and Montenegro relation is the burning and open issue still. Also, because there's one unsolved and very important for the politicians, of course, they are manipulating with the importance of that issue, which is the status of Serbian Orthodox Church in Montenegro. So we have really real priorities like reforms, like rule of law, fight against organized crime and corruption, like economy and election laws that has to be changed and many other reforms. But no, crucial issue in all debates is relation with Serbian Orthodox Church. Simply, I believe that politicians are making by purpose this narrative still very active because they are making the polarization even stronger and neglecting things that they cannot solve. Simply getting the political support on the identity and religious issues is their manner, and this is something which is not good. But also, I have to mention really relation between it's obvious and it's very openly said from everyone that official relations between Serbia and Montenegro were never worse. So we really have bad relations.
Let us return to Ireland. As the closest neighbour to the United Kingdom and as a former member of the Union, it is the closest comparator we have when looking at what sort of relationship a newly independent Scotland might have with the remaining UK. So how did first the Irish Free State and then the Republic of Ireland go about its foreign affairs once it became independent?
It's a really interesting question, and you could answer it in lots of different ways. I mean, on the one hand, Ireland is one of the only countries to have had a Department for Foreign Affairs before it was independent. That's when, during that conflict I mentioned at the start, from 1919 through to 21, in January 1919, there was a unilateral declaration of independence, which was ignored by Westminster at the time, and creation of a new Irish Parliament called the Dáil, or the Dáil, both pronunciations are used. That is the Irish part of the Irish Parliament today, the main part of the Irish Parliament. That was prescribed by Westminster at the time, and then it came to be the Irish Parliament after the Anglo-Irish Treaty was signed. So in 1919, Ireland established a Ministry for Foreign Affairs. So it clearly saw this sort of international relations as being very important to it. And it established offices in different countries. I remember at least in Berlin, but in lots of places in Europe as well. I don't think Ireland's foreign affairs mission really started until later on in the 20th century, however. It had participated in the League of Nations, very unsuccessfully, mind you, when the League of Nations were set up after the First World War. That was one of the first big international organizations. It sort of morphed into a new organization called the United Nations later on in the 40s into the 50s. Ireland became a member of that. And I think that's when Ireland's sort of foreign affairs or foreign policy image started to become much more clear. After the Civil War, Ireland did a remarkable job in terms of decommissioning most of those soldiers and guns in Ireland. I mean, actually, quite incredibly. And since the 40s and 50s, it's always been or offered its services in terms of peacekeeping. Yeah, it's never been an active military participant. It always has a policy of neutrality, most controversially during the Second World War. Though we can also say, well, you know, with the question mark neutrality, it allowed, for example, you know, American bombers to land in Shannon Airport before going on to Afghanistan or Iraq, and often on the way back as well. And we now know they were engaged in rendition. So, you know, putting people into Guantanamo Bay. Anyway, so you can question how neutral really was Ireland or is Ireland, and particularly now as well when it's come out very fervently in support of Ukraine. etc. But still, it has this policy of neutrality. It's non-interventionist in terms of wards, not a part of NATO. Its foreign affairs image is a story of the second half of the 20th century. It's a small island. I think it's well aware of its limitations. You know, it doesn't have a huge army, it doesn't have a huge navy, nor does it want either of those. And it's, yeah, it thinks it's much better preserved as a country that can champion peace, champion mediating relations between different countries than some of the major powers that surround it, who have different histories of empire and aggression or security or whatever way you want to phrase that. It comes out in different ways by different politicians and different governments. So yes, it's really, again, part of this story of trying to distance itself from its closest neighbour, but also establishing itself on the world stage in a way that it thinks is good for it.
That was Niamh Gallagher, a lecturer in British and Irish history at the University of Cambridge. One significant difference between the newly created Irish Free State and what would be a newly independent Scotland is the context from which both countries began their independence. Ireland, in stark contrast to Scotland, had suffered through years of armed conflict, beginning with the Easter Rising in 1916, followed by the War of Independence between 1919 and 1922, and latterly the Irish Civil War between 1922 and 1923, which pitted Republican against Republican. The scars of the First World War also ran deep through the country. These factors, Dr. Gallagher says, deeply affected how Ireland approached the early years of independence.
Did the Civil War scars impact foreign relations and foreign affairs? I'd say most certainly they did, but also as much in terms of emphasis or what political emphasis should be on, like, healing the country, trying to get it back together again, trying to establish itself as a sort of a nation that could kind of subsume these differences that were there in the Civil War. Part of the evidence for that is De Valera, who was so against the Oath of Allegiance in 1922 when Civil War began, comes to accept it later on that decade. Very quietly beneath the radar, he says, look, it's not important, we can ignore it, which might incite different feelings because there was a Civil War over this very principle. And yet less than 10 years later on, De Valera is saying, forget it, doesn't matter. But still, I think that helps show that the new emphasis on many governments, which were about building stability within, and therefore not spending a lot of time thinking about foreign affairs. I think it's also important just to spend a minute talking about neutrality in the Second World War. And I think that was an important part of it as well. Not only the Civil War helped to influence Dev's policy of neutrality, but I think more importantly, it was the memory of the First World War. And that's had a very contentious history in Ireland. We now know that there's really no difference between the proportion of Irish men who joined up in urban centres and the proportion of British men who joined up in urban centres. There's some disparity, but really not a sort of significant disparity. And we know that Irish people came to help assist the war in other ways, mainly through agricultural production in a largely rural place and space, plus all of those historic political complications between Britain and Ireland, which became even more amplified in the middle of the war with the Easter Rising, the rise of radical nationalism, the attempt by Westminster to conscript Ireland, which went down really badly. So lots of these sorts of very contested relationships between Britain, or really London and Ireland, were part of the First World War. Regardless, Irish service in the First World War was quite significant, and assisting in other ways was very significant too. But still, it was felt that in the 1920s and 30s, a sentiment that happened in Britain as well, the question of what had that war been for? You know, did we treat Germany too badly in the Treaty of Versailles? We could see new politics arising on the continent of communism and fascism. And then, of course, this all broke out again into another world war in 1939. So I think De Valera was very acutely aware that he did not want Irish men to be sucked into Britain, which can so easily happen when you're next to a very powerful neighbour. He also, again, was intent on, as I said, distancing Ireland from that British connection. And this is one key way in which to do so. Now, we can question how neutral Ireland really was. I mean, it shared weather data with the Allies. If any RAF plane that accidentally came down in Ireland, soldiers were sent back, whereas the Germans were interned. Probably better for the Germans at the end of the day because they would have survived it, whereas those pilots sent back probably, well, quite a number of them didn't, as we know. But still, the official policy was neutrality. Insofar as the Civil War, but also earlier wars, they did help to shape Ireland's stance in later years.
One thing Scotland does have in common with Ireland is a far-reaching and deeply rooted diaspora. The strength of the Irish diaspora, particularly strong in the United States, to where many emigrated, was and remains a key part of the Irish approach to foreign policy.
When we think about Ireland, we can't just think about Ireland in terms of the island or indeed 26 counties. In 1911, one third of Irish-born people lived abroad. One third, right? And this continues in the decades that follow, but also the second generation consider themselves as Irish as their parents, yeah? And, you know, Ireland has built up huge populations of people all throughout the former British Empire, but notably in America since the Great Famine of 1845. Those relations became very important for Ireland. In 1918, Sinn Féin hoped they would be really important and hoped that America would unilaterally bestow independence on Ireland. But Woodrow Wilson had, who is himself of Ulster Presbyterian roots or Presbyterian roots back in the day, had zero interest of really engaging with Ireland at all. He thought it's a British problem. However, Irish Americans became much more influential. As we know, JFK, the first Catholic president, and then more recently, you know, we've Joe Biden making that very famous comment when the BBC asked him a question saying, "The BBC, I'm not British, I'm Irish." So Irish Americans become very important. It certainly was noted as a potential threat by British policymakers or British ministers, most notably Winston Churchill, who always had his eye on America and realised that Irish Americans might be a thorn in the side for Britain. And I think that's very much a sentiment today. We've seen it with the Northern Ireland Protocol. We've seen that the Biden administration and the Senate have been very clear that there should be no messing with that agreement over pursuing the pursuit of Brexit. Who knows what this government, the Conservative government strategy is on that. But yes, Irish immigrants were always important. They were important in sending financial aid to Ireland. They were important as a kind of a valve that allowed Irish people to leave Ireland when those repressive policies in the 1930s were really underway and to find employment and some sort of stability elsewhere, albeit in very difficult circumstances. And then much more recently, as we now know, Irish Americans are very much call themselves Irish or have a kind of Irish ancestry that they're proud of, and they're in significant positions of power. And that is important in a context whereby America is the major superpower, still is in the world, got China as a threat, sure, but in terms of how the West conceives of its own geopolitical power relations, America's the key partner. The UK will be looking to America for new trade deals. It's not going to get them with the Biden administration if there's any tampering with the Good Friday Agreement. So it remains to be seen how this Northern Ireland Protocol Bill will be interpreted by the Americans. The Northern Ireland Protocol Bill currently going through the committee stages at present. But maybe there's also a hope that the next US president might be somebody like Trump, who might give, you know, might care a lot less and might be very willing to go for trade deals, regardless of what's done to the protocol. We just don't know, and it remains to be seen. But Irish America is very important and has been for Ireland. It's the kind of imagined home of Irish people. Like, Irish people went to America and had wonderful lives. They didn't, by the way. Some of them had really dreadful lives. But those connections have been always really important. And the two people who always get the biggest turnout in Ireland are, well, certainly this is true up until at least the 70s, is one, the Pope, and then two, the American president. So when JFK came to Ireland, huge crowds, and every American president claimed some sort of Irish heritage. Funnily enough, most Irish presidents, their Irish heritage is actually of Ulster Presbyterian stock due to the emigration in the 18th century. However, more recently, it's been of an Irish Catholic stock. So yes, those connections are really important.
Much is made of the success of Ireland in recent decades by Scottish nationalists. But it is key to remember, as discussed in previous episodes, how important the decision to join the European Union was to the country's prosperity. The availability of these large, membership-based, multilateral and international organisations was key to the development of the so-called Celtic Tiger of the 90s and early noughties.
The importance of having allies and bigger units, bigger institutions to be a part of. Ireland became wealthy in the EU, without a doubt. Now, none of us knows how much longer huge multilateral or federal organisations can last, but it doesn't seem like it's going away in any point soon. And I think those relationships were crucial for Ireland. Ireland had no other way of breaking that kind of connection with Britain other than joining the EU. And even then, you know, that doesn't mean that Ireland has severed all economic ties with Britain. Indeed, the irony is that most of the British exports to the EU, a lot of them actually went to the Republic of Ireland. And similarly, the Republic of Ireland's exports to the EU really went to Britain, 46% of them. I mean, a huge number of them. Having those connections with other places is important, and that comes with you know, both opportunities, but people might see it as costs. There'll be certain, I suppose, aspects of so-called sovereignty that need to be surrendered. You know, Ireland has not had an easy relationship with the EU. No country has. The Lisbon Treaty, for example, which was rejected by referendum in Ireland on, you know, a couple of occasions, you know, it kept being presented to the electorate until they voted the right way. So in a way, you know, you might ask about questions around democracy and sovereignty, all of which are surrendered a little bit to be part of a larger multilateral, multi-federal state or system. And I imagine to each of your listeners, they will have different views on whether that's a good thing or a bad thing. In Ireland's case, it was both very good because it managed to make itself not the most poor country in Europe, actually an attractive place. And with that, I think came the emphasis on liberalism, which is the characteristic of the state today. A lot of that came from being a part of a wider entity and building those relationships.
Dr. Gallagher also draws lessons from the failure of the Northern Ireland political class and the Irish political class to have meaningful cross-border relationships.
The Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland had almost no relations, no formal political relations right through and from 1922 until 1968. It's hard to believe. But there was not one formal meeting between the heads of government in either administration. This is part of, as I say, you know, the way of Ireland trying to create itself and distance itself from the British connection. By doing so, it's creating these new definitions of Irishness that can seem quite narrow. All of this was watched closely by the government in the north, which was doing exactly the same thing, trying to define Northern Ireland as a Protestant majoritarian administration, a British administration, which had very negative consequences, much more negative consequences for the Catholics who remained in Northern Ireland. So these two systems are sort of watching each other and feeding each other and defining themselves against each other, which, you know, helped or I suppose facilitated some of the, well, abhorrent policies that provided that larger structural background to the troubles in Northern Ireland. The abolition of proportional representation, which obviously is very good for minorities, gerrymandering, county borders, so one man, one vote didn't apply, discrimination in terms of welfare access, or indeed access to employment. This is all the stuff of Northern Ireland in those early decades of the state's formation, a lot of which is happening because it is, on the one hand, trying to shore itself up as a Protestant British administration within the wider UK, but at the same time, because it's watching the Catholic state down south developing in a similar way and it's reacting against it. So the lesson there, though I think would be very different, would be if Scotland did get independence, it would be to try and have a better relationship with the neighbours down south than happened in the island of Ireland. I think the island of Ireland is an example of how not to go about and do it. I would do, in fact, the complete opposite. You need to make sure that the relations remain good, even if you can't understand the governments who are in power, say in Westminster, you need to find a way to cooperate or at least listen rather than the non-compromising stance that became so much a part of the politics of the island and which led to fairly horrible, disastrous consequences in Northern Ireland from 1968 onwards.
Looking beyond the European Union and the military alliance of NATO, how have independent countries fared when looking to set up broader global infrastructure? Professor Fawn is back to describe how some countries managed the transition from subnational, where previously they would have been considered part of a larger nation, to full statehood, and the importance of having that global diaspora.
This partly depended on the size and the wealth, and I would actually also argue the number of international friends these countries had. So a socialist Poland, which was the biggest by population country in the bloc, excluding the Soviet Union, already had a series of embassies. And it was helped by having a huge diaspora, particularly in the United States. And people like Zbigniew Brzezinski was a presidential national security advisor, you know, arguing Poland's case. Other countries have fared less well. You get some post-communist countries that have populations smaller than Scotland, say Slovenia, 2 million, Montenegro, even far less than that. So you do have some fairly decisive economic questions. You know, what capacity is there to physically make foreign policy, you know, both in terms of the ministry diplomat side, but also the physical presences that you need abroad. And then the softer side, as I think of it, how you promote yourself and who you have helping you, hence the friends who can include diaspora. That's not to say that this can't be done. And I think what is quite striking is how relatively small countries have done a disproportionately good job at promoting themselves. And this is where some savvy thinking, some savvy self-promotion can do a lot of good. So countries do brand themselves. Countries very literally, like products, will take out advertisements. I mean, there are many post-communist countries that have run ads on major television channels. There are international events that you can try to become involved in, indeed, in try to capture. I mean, one that really strikes me is Azerbaijan, which is a country that has come to host the Grand Prix, Eurovision, many other things. And that is a great way, I think, of getting international renommé at relatively little cost, you know, and into the popular mind. I mean, it's not just because we're coming off Eurovision right now, but, you know, we know millions of people tune in for that. And perhaps they hadn't thought about Baku before, but they certainly do if you spend, you know, 3 or 4 hours with Eurovision. So there are different ways that countries can play this up. And I expect that that would happen. And I think Scotland has, I mean, as a North American, I've been aware of different European diasporas. And it was very, very hard growing up in very multi-ethnic, multinational Canada not to be aware of pronounced diasporas. I mean, I knew the Ukrainian diaspora intrinsically well. They were, you know, kind of unavoidable. Thus, for me, on just a personal, let alone a professional level, when the Russian president makes these, I mean, historically insane comments about the Ukrainians not existing as a people, you know, that really jars with me, because I knew the Ukrainian identity in Canada from the millions of Ukrainians who left the Russian Empire in the later 19th century and settled in Canada. And that diaspora, when we talk about diaspora, of course, includes the Scottish. I come from a part of Canada that was quite heavily Scottish settled, where we have a lot of Scottish place names. And of course, there's a Scottish diaspora in the United States, which promotes itself. I would say perhaps not as extensively as the Irish diaspora, but it is to say that there are people. There are historical experiences. There's popular cultural references that many European countries can latch on to. And in that way, if Scotland were to become independent, I think it has a massive head start on this. And you could see a lot of these things being galvanized very, very quickly.
Concerns about requiring a huge outlay of money to set up an independent network of embassies might also not truly represent the reality of what an independent Scotland may come up against.
We saw creativity in the early 1990s. You had premises sharing by major West European countries. Britain, France, Germany in the post-Soviet space were sharing premises to reduce costs. You have countries, wealthy Nordic countries, that do not have in-country ambassadors in whole regions. They have ambassadors who visit. So some of these, again, wealthy Nordic countries do not have embassies in a whole region like Central Asia, where they may have pronounced interests like hydrocarbons. Massive cost savings. You could argue that it reduces the presence. Another benefit is, of course, the European Union, because technically any citizen of the European Union can go to an EU delegation. And I don't know offhand, but I think the last time I looked, the EU has physical representations in some 119 countries. I mean, it's certainly enormous, and the majority of countries. So there are ways of working with partners. The Czechs and Slovaks did that. They give joint representation to each other. They both belong to something called the Visegrad Group, which is 4 Central European countries. There have been experiments there of giving diplomatic consular assistance to any one of the 4 countries. So there are a lot of things that could happen. And there's a very, very natural, unless there's a violent breakup like the Russian-Ukrainian dynamic, horrendously, if there's a civil and negotiated breakup like the Czech and Slovak and some of the Yugoslav ones like Slovenia breaking away, then you do see afterwards actually very, very good relations. And knowing a lot of the Czech and Slovak diplomats and their interactions, they talk to each other immediately in whatever forums they are in. You know, be it the EU, the UN, and so on, they're natural counterparts to each other. They help each other. I expect any new European country would be in a similar situation. You know, there's going to be a lot of holdovers from history, from institutional relations, from personal relations that will moderate some of the costs, the outright costs of formally setting up foreign policy. So I think you'll see a lot of inventiveness. You'll see a kind of soft substitutes for foreign relations. You'll see alternative forms of representations. We can't expect, and again, big wealthy European countries don't do it, that you have representations in every country.
One central criticism of the pro-independence campaign from unionists is that such a decision, leaving the United Kingdom and its diplomatic might behind, would leave Scotland lacking in international clout. Professor Fawn agrees that that is indeed a risk, and one a newly independent Scotland would have to navigate.
There are going to be risks. There are also opportunities. And we can make a long list of what we might call small states, who, again, I think have a disproportionate influence. They have a disproportionate influence because they have found niches. So take Norway, 4 or 5 million people. That's small even by European standards. They made quite a niche for themselves in international mediation, in Nobel Prizes, in human security. I mean, in that particular case, they have the benefits of well-used hydrocarbon income, but there's still ways at relatively low cost where countries can promote themselves through good ideas and good values. So it most certainly can be done, and it can be done more easily when a newly independent, newly recognized entity has a history to work with. I think Slovakia had a harder time. It's done remarkably well, but it had a harder time because it had been subsumed in that hybrid entity of Czechoslovak, which was so often and incorrectly abbreviated simply to Czech. So creating, asserting this new Slovak identity, I think, was much more difficult. And in that particular case, it was even more difficult because there was, unfortunately, quite routine confusion between Slovakia and Slovenia, near countries which sounded relatively similar in name, especially when they're, you know, in the whole scope of global politics, when they were physically close to each other and sounded an awful lot like each other. But you can still overcome these things. I would have little doubt about that. And that comes from not so much having a big budget. You know, there are countries that have a big foreign policy budget and don't promote themselves well. And it comes from, I think, potentially good personalities, good societal values, and doing things that have resonance in the larger international community. And I think doing things that are attractive on a societal level. I mean, Edinburgh, I think, is an absolute world leader in different types of fairs, you know, fringe, film, book, science, and so on. You know, you can do things that attract different communities. And that has the double effect of internationalizing your society and promoting that society. You get an association in different types of communities with your country. So I'd come back to, say, a country like Azerbaijan, which may not be on many people's radar, but is for things like Eurovision, is for the Grand Prix, is, you know, again, these are very, very different communities. And there are many other initiatives that I could mention in those cases where they're reaching out to different types of states, different types of communities. With initiative, it's doable. It's not to say that there aren't challenges. I mean, absolutely there are challenges. And I think that there's going to be some turbulence when any entity makes that kind of adjustment. You know, and that was the case for many of these countries, you know, trying to sort themselves out, trying to very literally on a physical plant basis, on a staffing basis, figuring out what they have and what they're going to prioritize, who they're going to send, what they're going to economize on. But these are also things that bureaucracies often have to do.
Professor Fawn is in a unique position of having witnessed several countries go through the process of becoming independent in a rapidly modernizing and changing world. So what should Scots, posed with the question of whether to vote in favour of becoming an independent country, consider when making that decision?
Well, to me, having watched now over a long time, a number of countries come into international existence and others actually having failed in doing so, I think the points are probably obvious ones, but they need to be said. One is, this really does need to be considered. Don't take anything for granted. Don't take anything lightly. Two, think about the costs and the benefits. You know, these are things that really do need to be studied and worked out. And if anybody's going to do that, it's quite essential that there is a game plan. And that includes what I've been calling the soft side, how we're going to promote ourselves, but also the hard side. You know, what costing does this mean? Does it mean if we don't want to increase public expenditure by increasing bureaucracies, how are we going to do these things with existing or perhaps even less staffing? And then having a connect between what the elite, the political project might be, and what the society might be. Because especially when we're in a project of state making and nation making, as so many of these places across Central, Southeastern Europe, former Soviet Union, have done, it's very important, but also very tricky at times, to get that kind of concurrence between elite views and the people who are thinking about this all the time and may have particular views, particular agendas even, and what are wider views and expectations. Because if you want any of this to work in the longer term, and if you want it to have returns for that society, including economic, it has to be done well. So as a takeaway, this is a big project. You know, I've made points about how it can be done and that it is certainly done. And there are reservoirs of potential, of initiative, of goodwill, of others around the world who can assist, it's a serious undertaking. And there's nothing in it that preordains success. As I've said, there are many cases where this has not gone particularly well. And there's also a risk, and it partly depends on the process itself, there's partly a risk that some of these countries can do themselves enormous damage. I mean, I've certainly seen in some of these successor states where they have spent an awful lot of time doing a kind of rearguard action, you know, trying to correct either actualities that happened or perceptions that have been generated or a combination of them. So it is a serious undertaking. It's one that needs a lot of thought, a lot of planning, and a lot of anticipation of contingency. You know, you're going out there, it's a bit like any artist who's putting a film, a poem, a work out into the public. You know, the public might react differently to how the initiator saw it. So it's a serious process. It's a multifaceted process.
The questions around what sort of foreign policy an independent Scotland may have, what its priorities could be, and whether it seeks membership of large multilateral organisations will dominate any future campaign around independence. It is also the case that the arguments both for and against independence that touch on this topic often mask the nuance of both the opportunities and the risks for Scotland post-referendum. There is no simple answer, nor even any real close comparison on which you can base educated guesses for what an independent Scotland's influence on the world stage would be, nor how countries may look at us. Like many of the questions around independence, the answers will likely only become clear over time. Next week on How to Be an Independent Country, Scotland's Choices, we look at one question that is rarely discussed by those on either side of the constitutional coin in Scotland. What happens if Scotland votes no again? You can find out more about this series each week in Saturday's edition of The Scotsman and online at scotsman.com. How to Be an Independent Country, Scotland's Choices is produced and hosted by me, Conor Matchett, and edited by Kelly Crichton.